Would you open your Bibles, please, to Ruth chapter 2, verse 8. A lot was happening last week. We saw that Naomi happened to have an important relative in Bethlehem named Boaz, which is good news for a nothing-to-your-name person in a who-you-know world. We also saw that Ruth, Naomi's loyal representative, happened to take the initiative and got right to work providing for her needs out in the fields of Bethlehem. Then we saw that out of all the family plots that Ruth could have gone to work in, she just happened to go glean in Boaz's part of the barley field, and that Boaz just happened to show up while Ruth was there, and that he was a God-fearing man. What are the odds? Finally, we saw that even with everything else going on, even though she was a foreigner, even though there was lots of people in this crowded field, Boaz still happened to take notice of Ruth. How about you? Aren't you glad that a nothing-to-your-name person like you knows Jesus? Aren't you glad that you have a loyal representative in Jesus Christ who takes the initiative to go out to work for your needs? And aren't you glad that a nothing-to-your-name person like you knows Jesus, because out of all the people and places that Jesus could have gone to, God took notice of you and sent Jesus to you at just the right time and at just the right place in order to be both your representative, like Ruth, as well as your benefactor, like Boaz will turn out to be today. Aren't you glad that God's personal, purposeful, powerful providence is at work to show his people loyal love, even behind what appears to be coincidence? I know I am. I'm very grateful. And so we left off last week with Boaz having taken notice of Ruth. Ruth, the Moabite woman. Ruth, the foreigner. Ruth, the faith-filled seeker of grace. The Hebrew word hen that we translate favor or grace appears twice in our text today. And Ruth is a seeker of grace whom providence has steered to this field and to this gracious man and to this gracious moment that has been graciously prepared from before the foundation of the world. So that it almost seems as if Naomi and Ruth are literally surrounded by providential grace. And in fact, they are. And so are you. What we're going to continue to see demonstrated all throughout our text today, that God's people are surrounded by favor. We're surrounded by God's grace. We see this first in the means God uses to show his grace towards Ruth. When she left Naomi, you might remember at the beginning of chapter 2, Ruth said she was off to glean among the ears of grain after him, after someone in whose sight I shall find favor or grace. And now we find out who that someone turns out to be. We find out that the route or the means of God's grace to Ruth is a happy-to-do-it Boaz. Boaz spots Ruth standing there. He interrogates his frazzled foreman, and he finds out that Ruth has asked this really audacious thing and has been, by all appearances, waiting there all day for an answer. She's not there to harvest. She is there to glean because she's a widow and she's a foreigner. God, who cares about the least, the little, the last, and the lost, had made gracious provision in his law so that such people wouldn't starve in Israel. Remember we said last week he'd instructed all landowners essentially to harvest their fields in what way? What kind of way? In an inefficient way, right? The harvest was supposed to be inefficient. They were to reap so inefficiently that those with no one else to look after them, the orphan, the widow, the poor, the immigrant, might be able to use what was dropped or left behind in order to survive. But instead of waiting for the reapers to finish before she starts gleaning, Boaz learns Ruth has asked for still more grace. She's actually asked for permission, we saw last week, to get ahead of all the other gleaners and get first dibs on the loose grain by working in the field even while the reapers are still reaping. In other words, even during the shift, she's not waiting for the whistles to blow and going with everybody else afterwards to, you know, sort of a race to get what's on the ground. No, she wants to go in before everybody else during the shift. And here's how Boaz responds. He turns to Ruth and basically says, "Young lady, you've come to the right place. Don't go anywhere else." He says, "Trust me, you'll be taken care of here." Look with me now at verses 8 and 9. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." So the fact that that Boaz calls Ruth daughter tells us something. It tells us he's probably older than her. You'll remember it's the same thing Naomi called Ruth at the beginning of chapter 2, daughter. So he's probably closer to Naomi in age than he is to Ruth. And so if Ruth is in her 20s, Boaz is probably between 45 and 55 years old. And for some reason, that sounds a lot less old than it used to. But as one commentator pointed out, calling her daughter also tells us that he addressed her with the tenderness and proper distance of a father speaking to his young daughter. In other words, he's careful to speak appropriately to her. This is an appropriate way of addressing a young woman. He speaks to her with authority, but also with proper respect, in a way that would have put her immediately at ease. And I say that he speaks with authority because he gives Ruth two prohibitions followed by two commands. He starts by giving her two do nots. So first he says, do not go glean in another field. And then to be crystal clear, he quickly adds, don't even leave this one. So my question is, why would Boaz feel the need to say these things if Ruth has already asked to glean in his field? Several commentaries I looked at suggested that Boaz says this because he knows and Ruth knows that there is apparently some advantage for gleaners in jumping from field to field instead of sticking to just one field or just one part of the field. Maybe it was like, you know, how on Halloween you know there are certain neighborhoods that are more generous with candy than other neighborhoods, and so instead of staying in the same neighborhood all night, you've learned that if you spend less time in each of these other neighborhoods and you just sort of jump around, you will maximize your candy haul by the end of the night. I know none of you do that, but maybe that's the idea here. And so it's possible that in the same way, certain landowners in Israel had a reputation for leaving more for gleaners to gather than others, and people were gaming the system by hopping from field to field. If that's the case, what it means is that Boaz is essentially telling Ruth to trust him instead of trusting the way everyone else does things. Right? Trust me, he says. I'll make it worth your while to stay. It's what Jesus says to you too. You might have noticed. I was talking to a young man this week. He doesn't go to our church here, but I was talking to this young man. He admitted it can be hard. I think we've probably all felt this. It can be hard to look out and see non-Christians doing things that Christians aren't supposed to do, especially when those are things we sort of wish we could do. There's things we're not permitted to do if we love Jesus, and it's hard because many of those things seem really fun, this guy said to me. They look really exciting. I want to go do those things. And to top it all off, the people doing those things, they sort of look like they're getting ahead in life. A lot of times, right? They're gaining an edge or an advantage. They're living it up. He says, you know, they're getting lots of good things that we're not getting. It feels like they're gaming the system. But Jesus says to you, young woman, young man, do not go into any other field. Don't leave this one. Trust me, I will make it worth your while to stay. And that's what I shared with that young man this week as well. I said, you know, it's not like you're the first guy in history to feel that way. I said, let's look at what King David learned from God in Psalm 37, I said to him. And so we turned there, and I read to him these words: "Fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers, for they will soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him, and he will act. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Fret not yourselves over the one who prospers in his way, over the man who carries out evil devices." Well, what does Boaz do to convince Ruth she'll have it better if she stays in his field, in this field? Well, first, he tells her that she'll already have an advantage over the other gleaners, because the first thing he tells her is that he's going to graciously grant her request to glean even during the shift, even while the reapers are still reaping. "Now listen, my daughter," he says, "do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women." These are the, he's talking about here, the hired women or the servant women, that the ones who will follow right after the men while they're reaping. So this is during the shift, okay? These are the women who are binding up the piles of grain that the reapers have cut and laid behind them in rows, and they're doing this during the shift. In other words, Boaz first says, "Go ahead and do what you've asked. You came to my foreman, he didn't know what to tell you, but look, the boss is here, and I'm telling you, go ahead, do what you've asked. You may glean close to the workers even while they work." This is Boaz already going above and beyond what's required by the law. But he's not done. Second, Boaz seems to say he'll grant her a sort of, this is really amazing, a sort of temporary status as part of the harvest team, as part of the household. Some form of status like most favored gleaner or honorary seasonal worker. And I say that for a couple reasons. For starters, because he says next, "Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them." Now, while that sounds like, to us, like Boaz is only talking about the one part of the field they're in now, the likelihood is that they're not going to be in that same part of the field all day, much less the rest of the harvest season, which typically lasted anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks. And so it's likely that by instructing Ruth to keep her eyes fixed on the field where his workers are working, that he's saying to do so in regards to whatever field or whatever part of the field they go to, whether now or later. In other words, this isn't a one-time ticket to glean among his workers during one shift. It's literally a season pass. And this seems to be confirmed later, if you look later in chapter 2 in verse 23, where we're told that Ruth kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and the wheat harvest. That comes after the barley harvest. So that's at least a period of 4 to 8 weeks that she's just been given permission for. What other gracious advantages might this bring to Ruth, aside from a sort of prolonged job security? Well, how about actual physical security as well? "Have I not charged the young men not to touch you?" Boaz adds next. The sense of his assurance makes it hard to tell if he means he's already done this, he's already talked to them, or if it's simply so sure of a thing, he's saying it's as good as done. Either way, he says, "No one's going to touch you, Ruth." That word for touch here has three typical meanings in the Old Testament: to strike, to inflict injury, or to rape. Now, the threat of rape wouldn't be impossible in this setting, but it would be more improbable with so many workers around. And so it's most likely Boaz is issuing his gracious protection against any other form of physical abuse or mistreatment that Ruth might otherwise face. As one commentator put it, "No man would dare to be rude to Ruth if she became one of the hired women laborers connected to a powerful man like Boaz. No one's going to touch you, Ruth." But why would Boaz have to protect her like that? One even if we're not talking about rape and we're talking about physical abuse, why would he have to protect her from that? Well, one commentator says it's because gleaners, kind of a habit of gleaners, was to aggressively push the limits of God's gracious law and overstep the line between the gleaner and the reaper. So, you know, Ruth comes and asks permission, but apparently there are gleaners who will come and they'll sneak onto the field and they'll not wait for the shift to be over and they'll get in there and try and take what belongs to the master. Just like today, there are always those who will try to make handouts out of something that's meant to be a hand up. Right? Nothing changes. There's people back then, just like today, who will abuse the generosity of others. Almost every week here at Westside Church, the deacons have to filter through requests for financial help from people in the community and try to sort of chase off those who are just trying to make an easy buck off God's people, to try and scam us. I'm pretty gullible, so that's why I pass it on to the deacons. I let them figure it out. And the result for us, so the sad part is, the result for us in leadership is that we can grow pretty cynical. We can, our default attitude can become an attitude of suspicion towards those who come for help. And the result among the typical field worker during harvest time in Bethlehem was very similar. As Leon Morris puts it, it wasn't uncommon that the reapers might repulse by force, if necessary, anyone who came too near before the owners were through with their field. Add to that the possible, very likely prejudice against a Moabite immigrant trying to take advantage of the nation's laws, and you can see why there was such, why these words from Boaz would be such welcome security to Ruth. No one's going to touch you, Ruth. You're with me. Finally, on top of everything else, Boaz adds this last reason to stay in his field. He says this, "And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." It was really interesting to read this week and be in the commentaries and be reminded how often in the Bible it's the women who are expected to draw the water from the wells for the men to drink, especially if they were foreign women. It was like, if you were a foreign woman somewhere, that was like your job. Like, you were always the one being sort of made to do that. But here, instead of touching Ruth in any way, the young men of Boaz are told to permit her to drink from the jars they themselves have worked to fill and haul to this field, all the way from the well at the gate of Bethlehem, most likely. What an interesting touch, one commentator wrote. A foreign woman who customarily would draw water for Israelites was welcome to drink water drawn by Israelites. You know, in no other field is Ruth going to get treatment like this. In no other field is Ruth going to have such an extravagant offer. You know, in any other field, without that water, even determined, plucky Ruth, without that water, her most determined efforts at gleaning would have eventually ground to a halt in the afternoon heat. And so we can imagine Boaz saying, gathering the servants and saying to them, "Everyone, this is Ruth, the Moabitess. She's going to be joining us for the rest of the harvest. I expect you to treat her like she's one of us." What does Boaz do to convince Ruth to trust that she'll have it better if she stays in his field? He shows her not just the audacious favor she asks for. He shows her grace beyond grace. You might even call it amazing grace. God's people are surrounded by God's grace. We see this first in the way God uses Boaz, one of his people, to be the route of his grace. And we also see this now as another one of God's people is the recipient of that grace, because the recipient of God's grace is an unentitled Ruth. Look now at verse 10. "Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, 'Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?'" Ruth falls first to her knees, and then she bows before Boaz all the way until her forehead is almost touching the ground. Have you ever said thank you to someone and it just felt like it wasn't quite enough? I know I have. You're just like, I wish, you know, thank you doesn't cut it. Like, it's like it's completely inadequate to communicate the enormity of your gratitude in a particular moment. And I think that's what Ruth is feeling too. But, you know, at least in her culture, in her day, there was a means of demonstrating that humble gratitude in a more satisfying, meaningful way, and that's what she's doing here. She is acting out her astonishment, as one commentator put it. The symbolism was graphic, writes R. Hubbard Jr. Her vulnerable prostration physically expressed both the social distance between them, between her and Boaz, and her gratitude for Boaz's kindness. But you know, this week I kept wondering, you know, why does Ruth seem so surprised? I mean, after all, isn't this exactly what she told Naomi and probably God too, that she was going out to the fields to look for? Someone in whose sight I shall find favor, someone in whose sight I shall find grace. So why the astonishment when she actually finds that someone? I think if we're honest, even at our most optimistic, you know, when we're feeling really full of faith, I think even then, we also tend to be surprised when God answers our prayers the way we hoped. Isn't that true? I mean, we sort of wish we weren't surprised, we sort of wish we were like, yeah, I saw that coming all along. But usually, if we're honest, we're usually surprised. And so I think this reveals at least two things. First, how small our faith usually is. Second, how little of our faith is actually needed for God to find delight in it and graciously reward it. And that's encouraging. But I think in this case, it also reveals a third thing that often happens, that God doesn't respond to us in equal proportion to our faith at all. And you should be so glad about that. That he doesn't respond to us in equal proportion to our faith, but rather in accordance with the riches of his kindness, in accordance with the extravagance of his own loyal love. In other words, I think Ruth is humbled and overwhelmed, not just because God is showing her the favor through Boaz that she asked for and maybe even expected. I think she's overwhelmed because she's just been granted so much more than what she asked for through him. It's not just grace, it's amazing grace. And it's amazing grace because I think what she's gotten instead is something far closer to what one Israelite would show towards another Israelite, or to what God might show towards one of his own people. In other words, I think Ruth is astonished because Boaz is treating her with something closer to hesed than to hen, with something closer to covenant love, loyal love, than the simple favor or grace that she went looking for. And so she's rightly astonished and really wants to know why. She wants to know Boaz's motives. Why have I found favor in your eyes, she asks him, that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner? And I think she just keeps calling it favor because she doesn't know what else to call it. What is this thing that's happening to me? But again, I think what she's just been shown is loyal love, the kind of loyal love that Yahweh reserves for those he's committed to and responsible for in a special way, a covenant way, the kind of favor that's reserved only for insiders, only for Israelites. And Ruth may not know what to call it, but notice how she seems to know very well that the kind of treatment she's getting at this moment is not in keeping with her racial or ethnic status. Right? Notice, as one commentator put it, how Ruth remains mindful that she's an alien, an outsider, a foreigner, she even calls herself. I've mentioned this twice already in this series. There seems to have been an understood difference at this time between two categories of outsider living in Israel. There was a sojourner, also called a resident alien, and then there was a foreigner. Two different categories. The word translated sojourner or resident alien basically referred to a legal immigrant, to someone who was following legal steps to obtain recognized standing in Israel. Such a person qualified for protected legal status, even if they didn't have the full rights of a native Israelite. But that other category is different. And what Ruth is stammering out here while bowing low to the ground is that she's not even She's not even a sojourner, in her own mind at least. This is how she sees herself, as a foreigner. And so, why have I found favor in your eyes? She asked him. A person under the designation of foreigner had even less rights in Israel than the sojourner. The foreigner had a lower social status than the resident alien, writes R. Hubbard Jr. Since the foreigner did not belong to Yahweh's people, he enjoyed no covenant privileges. He could be charged interest for loans and could be forced to pay debts even in the year of release. Further, contact between him and Israelites was avoided, probably to minimize the influence of his religious practices. And that's what Ruth calls herself. That's how she sees herself, as a foreigner. And so, why have I found favor in your eyes, she asks him, that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner. Ruth is saying she knows that she doesn't barely deserve the right even to glean, much less the favor she's audaciously asked for. So why is she now receiving from Boaz, and by extension from God, this amazing, extravagant favor above and beyond what she's even asked for? In the words of one commentator, she was not family, but Boaz had treated her as if she were. As God says in Hosea, her who was not beloved, I will call beloved. And Ruth is asking, why? And friends, Ruth's question should be a model question for you and I too. It should be a model question for us. Not a model of little faith, but a model of modesty. It's a model of clear-eyed humility. This is a model of what a godly lack of entitlement looks like, because she knows she's not entitled to grace, to hen, much less the privilege of loyal love, the hesed reserved for God's covenant family. And neither are we. Neither are we. And so that same attitude reflected in the question she asks should be the ever astonished and grateful attitude of every Christian. It's not an attitude that asks, why would you let this bad thing happen to me, God? But an attitude that constantly wonders, why has anything good ever happened to me, God? To a stranger and an outsider like me, to a rebel sinner like me, why has anything good ever happened to me, God? Much less this extravagant show of love, because we weren't family, but God has treated us as if we were. God says to Hosea, those who were not my people, I will call my people. And you should want to know why. And the answer is because God loved you and sovereignly chose to show grace to you as part of his loyal love. The answer isn't ultimately because of any good found in you, but because of all the good that's found in God. God says, don't murder. And you think you're doing pretty well until you remember that coworker you hate and that Jesus said that's as good as killing him. God says, don't commit adultery, and you think you're doing pretty well until you remember the way you daydreamed about that other person this week and that Jesus says that's as good as cheating on your spouse. God says, don't steal, and you think you're doing pretty well until you remember that thing you borrowed from someone a long time ago and never gave back, and you realize Jesus says that's something the wicked do. And it occurs to you suddenly that even if you stopped right there without going on to the rest of the Ten Commandments, you're still a murdering, thieving adulterer. And suddenly you know that's not the kind of person God should be kind to. That's not the kind of person God should show favor to. No, that kind of person should be an outsider. That kind of person should be a foreigner, a sinner. Suddenly you know that's the kind of person God should condemn, not love. And every true Christian knows that and should admit that. But the good news is that instead of condemning you, God sends you Jesus. And just like Boaz, Jesus tells you not to go anywhere else but to trust him. And he verifies his trustworthiness by welcoming you into his household and assuring you that his generosity and that his protection will last until the great harvest is over. And in the meantime, he sees to it that all the work necessary for you to be refreshed and sustained by his living water is done for you. Because he carried a cross for you all the way past the gate in Bethlehem, past these fields, all the way to a hill called Calvary. There, an Israelite welcomes you, a foreigner, to come drink of the life-giving water he has drawn for you with his own nail-pierced hands. And that should astonish you. That should humble you. That should cause you to fall on your face and ask with Ruth, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner? You weren't family, but God has treated you as if you were. Why?" And the answer is simply because God loved you. God sovereignly chose to love you with his loyal love, and part of that involved showing grace to you. The answer to why isn't ultimately because of anything good found in you or in me, but because of all the good that's found in God. And yet, if you were paying attention to the story this morning, that claim should bring up at least maybe a small objection in your mind. Wait, you should be thinking, but that's not the way Boaz answers Ruth. Hold on, you should be thinking, that's not what he says to her next in the text. And you'd be right to a point. Because what we're going to see next is that the stated reason for this amazing grace shown to Ruth is Ruth's loyal love that she has shown to Naomi. But is that all there is to it? God's people are surrounded by God's grace. We've seen in this case that the route of God's grace is Boaz. We've seen that the recipient of that grace in this case is Ruth. And now we see third that the stated reason for this grace is Ruth's loyal love to Naomi. Look now at verses 11 and 12. "But Boaz answered her, 'All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. And how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge.'" Ah, you say, see, Boaz is gracious to her, and God is gracious to her because of what she did, because of her kindness and her loyal love shown to Naomi. And that's partly right, for sure. Somehow, Boaz has already heard quite a bit about Ruth, it seems like. He's known more about her than he's let on. It's a small town. People will talk, and someone in Bethlehem has already filled Boaz in, apparently, on all the things Naomi's daughter-in-law has done for her. The way she's looked out for Naomi ever since the death of her husband back in Moab. But now, apparently for the first time, Boaz has been able to put a face to the name. And he thinks, so this is the dear one who's given up so much for my relative. And so when he sees the opportunity to help her and reciprocate her kindness to Naomi, he gladly takes it. His generosity helps Ruth and it helps Naomi. It's done at his expense, but it's a sacrifice that's well worth it to him. It's a wonderful win-win. And so, "Why have I done it?" he says. "This is why. All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. And how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before." As one commentator summarizes it, Boaz's kindness towards Ruth simply reciprocated hers toward Naomi. But I have to ask, because I'm a little bit of a romantic, is that really all there was to it? I mean, I'm sure it's the main reason that Boaz is so kind to Ruth, but was that really the only reason? And so before we rush on to deeper things, let me just quickly insert here that I want to be careful not to over-spiritualize everything. All I mean is that I've noticed sometimes, sacrifices are easier to make when there's a very clear silver lining involved. Let me put it this way. There's a thing I say to my wife all the time when she asks me to do something that I really don't want to do. I say to her, "You're lucky you're so beautiful." And of course, what I really mean is that I'm lucky she's so beautiful. And my point here is, so is Boaz. I don't think it hurts that Ruth is a lovely young woman. It's a wonderful win-win. This is something God does in his kindness. That being said, there are deeper things at work here as well. For instance, right in the middle of Boaz's explanation here, you should notice that Boaz uses some very striking language that the Jewish reader would have picked up on. They would have noticed because it's an expression that only appears in one other place in the whole Old Testament, in the marriage passage in Genesis chapter 2 that talks about how a man will leave his father and mother. "You left your father and mother," Boaz says to Ruth. And I don't think the reader would have been able to keep from wondering, will marriage also be the result of Ruth leaving her father and mother? Then Boaz uses another phrase that would have been noticed by a Jewish reader because it's a phrase that echoed the faithful acts of the patriarchs like Abraham and Jacob who left their native land to follow God for his great redemptive purposes. "You left your native land and came to a people that you did not know before," Boaz says. That comparison is high praise, even if it's, I think it's intentional, but even if not, will some great redemptive purpose also come from Ruth leaving her native land? The reader would likewise wonder. This is a masterful author, by the way. Whatever the case, as one commentator puts it, Ruth's family loyalty toward Naomi had obviously impressed Boaz. And he's so impressed that he seems to sense that even the best he can do, even all he can do for Ruth, still isn't enough to repay what she's done for Naomi. And so all he can do now is leave it in God's hands and trust that he will pick up the repayment where Boaz leaves off. "The Lord repay you for what you have done," he finally says. I think, by the way, that's a great blessing in prayer when you are grateful to someone and don't know how else to express it. When you're overwhelmed but don't quite feel like, you know, getting down and bowing your forehead until it touches the ground. I don't think you need to do that, but you could certainly do or even say this and mean it. "The Lord repay you for what you have done." And then Boaz goes on to say this, and it's really important. "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." That last part is really important because it's like a public recognition. It's like a public declaration of something I think already took place privately in Ruth's heart. Boaz is acknowledging that like a vulnerable chick seeking refuge and rescue under the wings of its mother, Ruth's loyal actions towards Naomi prove that she has truly entrusted herself to Israel's God the way she said she was doing on the way back from Moab. You know, she long ago made a profession of faith on that lonely road. Remember, your people, my people. Your God, my God. But now the fruit of that trust in Yahweh has been recognized by someone. And so Boaz is publicly acknowledging that she's put her trust in Yahweh in such a way that she's now under the same wings of protection and care that are spread over all of Israel. In other words, though the story is far from over, I think this is Boaz welcoming Ruth, accepting Ruth for the first time as one of God's covenant people. Maybe you've privately put your trust in Yahweh too. You've believed you're a sinner in need of saving, and so you've entrusted yourself fully to the work of Jesus. His outstretched arms nailed to a cross are the wings of protection and care that you found refuge under. If that's true of you, the way a profession of faith is made public today is through baptism. That's how we do it now. It's the way God's people publicly welcome you into the family of God. And so all of that to say, I encourage you to sign up in the back. There's sign-ups back there to be baptized next month if you haven't been baptized already. But let's jump back for a moment to the pattern pieces being dropped into Boaz's response to Ruth, the language that echoes marriage and the faith of the patriarchs. I don't want us to forget those things, and here's why. Here's why. So I like to hunt, and I try to practice spotting deer, even in the off-season, when I'm driving somewhere or when I'm hiking somewhere. The thing is, you may not know this, deer are pretty skittish, the ones that are hunted, and so most of the time you don't see the whole deer. You might see only a head or an ear or some back leg sticking out of a bush, or maybe at best just a shadowy profile in the underbrush. All the same, this kind of practice trains you. If you're a hunter, it trains you for the real thing. It trains your eye. It trains your mind to leap when the pattern pieces of a deer you've long programmed into your mind finally materialize into the real thing. You see it. It's a deer. And that's what this language and these stories do too. The stories of a man leaving his father and mother to be joined to a bride. The stories of the patriarchs leaving behind their homeland in faith in pursuit of a promise. The stories of self-sacrifice for the sake of others. The stories of childless women miraculously given a child. All of these prepare the Jewish reader so that they'll one day leap in recognition at the pattern pieces they see finally and fully displayed in the life of Jesus. Jesus, who leaves his father and his native land in heaven. Jesus, born in Bethlehem to a woman who's miraculously with child. Jesus, who comes to a people who don't know him, all for a marriage that will save them. Jesus, who trusts his father and selflessly sacrifices everything out of loyal love for those he's come to save. All of which is to remind us that God is the one guiding this story. God is the one conforming Ruth into the image of his son. That's why her good works, all her loyal love shown towards Naomi, that's why it's so similar and familiar with what we'll one day see in Jesus. And so God has saved Ruth. God has rescued her from the domain of darkness. Orpah, he has justly allowed to turn back. But Ruth, he graciously plucked from the fire. He touched her heart and changed it in a way that he didn't do for Orpah. So that instead of fleeing and hiding from God, the way humanity has done since the fall, Ruth runs to him and seeks refuge beneath his wings. And in the process, God gifts her with a character like his own. He gives her a heart filled with loyal love. So that instead of looking out for herself, what does she do? She desires to seek the good of Naomi and does so. God is guiding the story. Which is why I think we need to confront the idea, the kind of idea that's put forward by Old Testament scholar Hermann Gunkel, who goes so far as to paraphrase Boaz's answer to Ruth's question this way. Don't thank me, you owe this to yourself. Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner? Because you earned it, Gunkel says. But in light of what we learned just last week about providence, is that really how we're supposed to see this story? Do you think? Is that the takeaway we're really supposed to have here, that God will help those who help themselves? Yes, it's true that after we're saved, after we are given the free gift of salvation, the Bible teaches we can earn rewards from God for our good works. But even then, does that mean we owe all the credit for those good works to ourselves? God's people are surrounded by God's grace, and we see this finally in the fact that even though God's route of grace tells God's recipient of grace that the reason for that grace is her own good works that deserve a reward. Even those good works were graciously given to her. They were prepared for her by God from before the foundation of the world. In other words, the last point we'll have time for today is that even the root of that grace, the source of that grace, is a self-glorifying Yahweh. Look with me now at verse 13. And she said, then she said, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants. What Ruth set out to find, she now knows she's found, and more. Not just grace, but amazing grace. Not just grace, but grace upon grace. God's gracious, loyal love. And so, after the mention of Yahweh by Boaz, I think she's not only crediting the source of this comfort and kindness to him, to Boaz, I think she's ultimately tracing it back to Yahweh. She's been shown favor by Boaz, yes. He's certainly the someone she was looking for at the beginning of the day, but at the end of the day, I think she knows she's been shown favor by Yahweh himself. And I don't think that's all we should trace back to Yahweh here, back to God. What the story of Ruth reminds us is that behind the scenes, God always goes before us and prepares the way, even when it comes to our own good works. As we're told in Ephesians 2, 9 and 10, for by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not your own doing. It is the gift of God, not a result of works, so that no one may boast, for we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. It's amazing. What this ultimately means is that God is going to reward Ruth for all the things he himself prepared for her to do. Does that blow your mind? That's like the dad rewarding his son with praise for the wonderful Father's Day gift that he gave his son the money for in the first place. God is going to reward Ruth and you and me one day as well for all he himself has first given us the ability and the opportunity to do. And that should blow your mind. That should astonish you. As Augustine famously said of God, in crowning our merits, you crown your own gifts. Friends, God's people are surrounded by God's grace. Why? Why would God do this? Well, because when God rewards good works, he is ultimately glorifying his own grace given to his people. He's glorifying himself. Why had God given to Ruth a new heart and gifted her with a character like this? It was to bless her, yes. It was for her sake, yes. But it was also to show his loyal love towards Naomi. In order to showcase his loyal love towards Naomi, God brings another lost soul into his kingdom and family. He sweeps Ruth up off her feet and up off the broad road that leads to destruction, and he sets her down on the narrow road that leads to Bethlehem, that leads to life. And as he does so, he gives these great gifts to her so that she can be a channel of his loyal love to Naomi, and it brings him glory to do this. And now God takes this man named Boaz, and today he begins using him as a channel of grace and loyal love towards Ruth as well. Why does God do all this? Because it's through all these acts of amazing grace that God will eventually sweep all of you who trust in Jesus off the broad road to destruction too and place you on the narrow road to life instead. God's people are surrounded by God's grace. You didn't even know it. Why does God do all this? He does it for our good, and he does it for his glory, for the sake of his people, and for the sake of his holy name. God does this because he is making a name for himself. The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness.